As I said, we've all heard of Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will. Murphy's Law portrays an outlook that says that life, frankly, is just not going to work. It portrays a mixture of pessimism and cynicism. Now, I went to the computer last night. I figured, well, let's look up Murphy's Law and just confirm exactly what it is. And there's actually a website for Murphy's Law. I mean, there's everything out there you ever imagined. And I want to read you a little bit about the description here of Murphy's Law, kind of give you the flavor of what it is I'm addressing. It says, it was Murphy who first observed that if anything can possibly go wrong, it will go wrong. Deceptive in its simplicity, this profound insight marked a turning point in our understanding of why things happen the way they do. Indelibly etching itself into the human psyche, this revelation ensured that never again would we look at the world in quite the same way. You have to understand that this is tongue-in-cheek, and yet what it is saying is partially true. It actually becomes part of how we look at this world. Murphy went on to expand on his theory and formulate the now famous laws that bear his name. Truly one of the great thinkers of our time. Now, there really was no Murphy, but, you know, for the story's sake, they had to put it to a specific place. Murphy somehow managed to unravel the very fabric of the cosmos itself and lay bare the relentless perversity with which it is woven. If anything simply cannot go wrong, it will anyway, he said. It was a defining moment in history, and Murphy's accomplishments provided the foundation for a host of others who would follow in his giant footsteps. There will only be one Murphy, but his successors have nonetheless made significant contributions to his work. And then it gives a few laws that have spread out from Murphy's Law. If there is a possibility of several things going wrong, the one that will cause the most damage will be the one to go wrong. Corollary. If there's a worse time for something to go wrong, it will happen then. If anything just cannot go wrong, it will anyway. If you perceive that there are four possible ways in which something can go wrong, and you circumvent those, then a fifth way, unprepared for, will promptly develop. Left to themselves, things tend to go from bad to worse. If everything seems to be going well, you have obviously overlooked something. Nature always sides with the hidden flaw. Now, this is an unbelievably complex website. They have love laws, tech laws, commerce, computer laws, real estate laws. They have a whole dictionary listing where they break Murphy's Laws down into subjects so that you can go. I couldn't find any on religion. But they had a few additions here. One of the laws, in nature, nothing is ever right. Therefore, if everything is going right, something is wrong. The chance of the bread falling with the buttered side down is directly proportional to the cost of the carpet. You understand why we're laughing? If it didn't have any connection at all, it wouldn't be funny. You will always find something in the last place you look. In order to get a loan, you must first prove you don't need it. If it jams, force it. If it breaks, it needed replacing anyway. No good deed goes unpunished. Anything dropped in the bathroom will fall in the toilet. And then I couldn't resist but to turn to Murphy's Laws of War. And again, pages of combat, little ditties. But the only one I pulled out there is, never forget that your weapon was made by the lowest bidder. And then at the end they have Sod's Law. Sod's Law says that Murphy was an optimist. And so, you know, when I was a paratrooper, we had a joke. They told us about how the parachutes worked and what they would do if they didn't work. And they said, well, you have two parachutes, and when you come out of the plane, there's a line attached to the plane, so that'll pull out the first parachute by itself. And if you're out there and the parachute gets tangled and you're flying, flopping down through the air, and you have to save yourself, and you pull the ripcord on the reserve chute, which is on your front, and that will inflate and save you. But if that tangles and doesn't work either, then don't worry, we all have a truck waiting for you at the bottom. And so the paratrooper jumps out of the plane, and the ripcord pulls, and the first chute comes out and tangles and snags up above him. He said, well, okay. He pulls the ripcord. The second chute comes out, snags, and turns up above him. He says, you know, I'm having a really bad day. With my luck, the truck won't even be there when I arrive. See, we Murphy's laws are funny because in some way to our thinking, they actually relate. But they relate in a rather cynical way, because they're a reflection sometimes of what our expectations come to be. As we watch the unfolding of the political process in Florida right now, we watch the attorneys start to argue back and forth, we watch the demonstrators out on the streets with their signs and the camera trying to narrow the focus so that it fills the whole lens and makes it look like the entire city has turned out. When we hear that now, after the first count, they did the second count, after the second count, they're going to do a third count, and they're going to do it by hand. And they're now going to examine every little piece of poked out dot of paper that's hanging, or if there's a dent that means maybe they wanted to vote and didn't, and that they're going to begin to assess the count in that way. Are we encouraged or are we distressed? Do we expect it will work out indeed in the best possible way, or do we sometimes suspect that it might indeed be the worst? I mean, we have to stop and analyze what runs into our minds. Many of the circumstances around us actually push us toward being pessimistic, being negative, expecting the worst. I read an article in the Spokesman Review on November the 6th, on Monday, this past week. And it really irritated me to read it. I try not to read the teen page in the paper because some of the articles that come flying through there to me are just, it's hard for me to imagine they put them in print. This is fairly neutrally written, but just what it refers to. The title is Students Have Varying Degrees of Allegiance. Every morning, barring the occasional administrative slip-up, a voice is heard crackling over the public address system in Moscow, Idaho High School, asking the students to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Many comply willingly, others grudgingly, and many simply refuse. The Pledge of Allegiance bill was passed by the Idaho State Legislature earlier in the year and has been in effect since the first day of the current school year. Every student, kindergarten through 12th grade, has the option of standing and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Many students feel that because it's optional, there should be no objections to the law. Others, however, claim that many teachers force their students to stand and say the pledge. If people force you to say the pledge, it isn't patriotism, says 16-year-old Brittany Tiff. Eric Edwards, also 16, added, "Why should I pledge my allegiance when the school tells me to?" One strong objection that some students have is the phrase which says, "One nation under God." Amanda Clowden, who's 16, chooses not to stand for the pledge because I don't like the words under God in it. Religion does not belong in public schools. Another common grievance is the idea of forced patriotism. Many students feel that if they choose not to say the pledge on their own, then it means nothing if they're forced to do it. Mary Fellman, of 16 years old, said, "I resent the idea that forced patriotism will make us good little citizens." Others argue that the reading of the pledge is simply an act to support patriotism, not to lead students blindly to it. Another student here, Dario Machlich, it's a German pronunciation, I don't think I can pronounce it, thinks that saying the pledge is not a big issue, therefore he sees no reason not to. Who cares? Support your country a little. You live here. Out of the sampling of Moscow, Idaho high school students polled, 52% said they did not stand for the pledge. 37% said they did, and 8% said they did sometimes. No matter how many people argue this issue, it seems that the pledge is here to stay, as no organized attempt to repeal the bill has been mounted. Some students suggested a revising of the pledge, which would mean what? Take out God, take out patriotism, take out I Pledge Allegiance. What do you have left to take out? But it does not seem likely to occur anytime soon. I read that article and I was angry. And then I reflected on what that bode for our future in terms of that attitude and approach, and it looked to me rather bleak indeed. Sometimes we become pessimistic because of what we see happening around us. Sometimes we become downright cynical. Now, until I began to look those terms up, I wasn't sure exactly what the distinction is. Cynicism is a type of pessimism. Pessimism is a reflection on the fact that events are not going to go well. Cynicism is a reflection on man's own values and nature. A cynic is a person who believes that everyone is motivated by selfishness. Now think about that from a Church of God perspective. A cynic is a person who believes that everyone is motivated by selfishness. The problem, though, with a cynic is he has trouble seeing people's honor and virtue. Now, we may not go there all the way, but I do believe we go there by degrees. It's simply an easy way to respond to what happens around us. It's an easy way to think, but it's poisonous just the same. Some women, because of circumstances in their life or upbringing, frankly, do not trust men. Some men, conversely, don't trust women. They become cynical in that way. I think that happened to Solomon. And I think one of the records in the Bible is a reference here to in the comments that Solomon made. And I'd like to read this to you and just show you at least what it would appear to me, how this impacted and colored his perspective of the world. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 27. Here's what I have found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason. You know, Mike said he has looked at that scripture on being thankful so many times and read it in all the different versions. That's what I've done with this. I said, what in the world was Solomon saying here? What could this really mean? Until I began to look at it as cynicism, as the viewpoint of someone who began to look at things in the worst possible way. Here's what I found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. He's talking about either nobility or character or quality or trustworthiness or relationship, or he's talking about he can't find anyone that he could trust or depend on or honor or relate to. He said, I found one man out of a thousand. He said, there wasn't a woman in sight. And I've always looked at that. I says, what in the world could that be? Well, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and he turned away from God, and he literally destroyed, in that sense, what would appear his ability to see virtue and uprightness that was indeed obviously there. Truly this one I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. I don't think I'm arguing for the fact that man turned away from God and went his own way. But in the context of man turning away from God and going his own way, Solomon, at least this point in time, appears to have become very cynical and negative in his perspective as a result. Does God allow us to become a cynic? Is that something that's in his point of view? Was Christ a cynic? Which of the apostles, James, Peter, John, Paul, Barnabas, which of those were pessimistic? Show me by their nature and the record of the Bible which one was pessimistic. The church was driven out of Jerusalem at one point in time and went out to preach the gospel. They were persecuted. Paul was beat to a pulp on a regular basis. Was he then a cynic? There was a negative attitude in the group, and occasionally that attitude put others at risk. Mark 14 is an account of a little issue of contention here before Christ's death. I'd like to read it to you, and then I'd like to show you where it comes from. Mark 14 and verse number 3. Being in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, he sat at the table, Christ. A woman came in having an alabaster flask of very costly oil of spikenard, and she broke the flask and poured it on his head. And there were some who were indignant among themselves and said, "Why was this fragrant oil wasted? It might have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they criticized her sharply. Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She's done a good work for me. For you have the poor with you always. Whoever you wish, you may do them, whatever you wish, you may do them good, but me you do not have always. She has done what she could. She has come beforehand to anoint my body for burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the whole world, what this woman did will also be spoken of as a memorial to her." It says there was some of them were indignant because this waste had taken place, that this had not in their eyes been properly handled. Immediately after this, it says Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priest to betray him to them. So right after this was like the last event before this circumstance here that says when Judas then began to plot and plan to betray Jesus Christ. Now John 12 takes this very same account and looks at it from a little different perspective. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. And there they made him supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table. And it shows Mary taking this very costly oil, anointing his feet, wiping his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. Then one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" That's about a year's wages for a worker of that day. A year's salary in this one bottle of oil. And it was used, and it was Judas who complained, not because he wanted to help the poor. It says not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief. And he had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. But you know what happened when Judas complained? In the first account in Mark, it showed that there were others around him who stopped and thought about the problem and decided that what he said was true. Now, they didn't know he was a thief, and they didn't know that he really didn't care. All they saw was a problem, and they invested themselves with them in the process. They bought in. That's what negativity, pessimism, cynicism does. It's an infection. Somebody indeed might be totally dishonorable in their intent, but their cause then is picked up and promoted by others around them. What it does, brethren, is it causes each other, it causes others to bring down their focus as well. And it becomes a poison that affects us spiritually. On the radio this week, I heard an ad, and I only heard it once, and so I said, "Well, that's interesting. Here's what I'm working on, you know, trying to address in my sermon." And this ad comes on, and it says, "We're cynics. We're told we've won $1 million. We're told that our favorite singer is still alive. We're told that the products we use are new and improved, and if we need help, we go to a place called customer service." Now, I don't have a clue what the product was because I was so fascinated with the jingle and then trying to make a note as to what it said, but the ad was written because it strikes a chord that is true. Sometimes we begin to look at life as if life itself is Murphy's Law and the worst possible thing will probably take place. What happens when our expectations are constantly lowered, when our hopes and dreams are reduced? What happens is, oftentimes, is that negatively affects our Christian focus as well. We're not compartmentalized in spite of whatever discussions there would be in terms of, well, this is over here and this is over here and the twain don't meet. No, we are an entity indeed, and what we think is what we do. Let me show you some example of that. Well, this one in Proverbs 22. How that affects us when we become cynical. Proverbs 22, verse number 9. He who sows iniquity will reap sorrow, and the rod of his anger will fail. He who has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he gives his bread to the poor. So what you're saying, there is cause and effect. And what we put into things oftentimes is what's going to come back to us. Cast out the scoffer, and contention will leave. Get rid of Judas, and you won't have the body of individuals infected by his disease. Yes, strife and reproach will cease. He who loves purity of heart and has grace on his lips, the king will be his friend. The eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, but he overthrows the words of the faithless. And then it says, the slothful man says, there's a lion outside, I will be slain in the streets. You know what that means? Why should I go do that? It's not going to work anyway. Why should I take the risk? I will only suffer and lose. Why should I participate? It doesn't do any good. Why should I try to talk to you again? We have never got along before. Why should we resolve this issue or try? Because it simply can't be fixed. Do you know what that does to your Christian perspective? When you begin to look at life in that way, it pulls down our whole focus. We're in a society, as we watch things take place, and frankly, when we look at it, we begin to believe the worst. And we have to struggle with that, brethren. We have to keep our focus and maintain our encouragement, and we have to hold on to our hope. We simply cannot allow ourselves to descend down into that kind of abyss. Ecclesiastes 11, cast your bread on the waters, for you will find it after many days. Feed the fish, and there will be a return. Make your investment. Give a serving to seven and also to eight, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. If a tree falls to the south or the north, and the place where that tree falls there, it's going to lie. In other words, if it happens, it happens. That's life. Now, don't let that stop you from moving forward or going ahead. Don't let that turn you back and begin to say it's not worth it, because the worst possible will happen anyway. Notice verse 4. He who observes the wind will not sow. He who regards the clouds will not reap. If we sit around and wait for everything to be right, it will never be right, and we will never be done, whatever task it will be that lie in front of us. If we wait until we're rested, we will never study. If we wait until there's time, we will never have it. If we need to mend relationships and we wait for the moment, the moment may never appear. If you're watching the wind, you'll never sow. You'll just keep your seed tucked away in the barn waiting for the time. 1 Corinthians 7 applies this in a marriage relationship. I thought this was interesting as I was trying to reflect on it and study the implications here. 1 Corinthians 7. Verse number 12. This is talking about situations in regard to marriage. In this case, verse 12 says, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she's willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. If a woman who has a husband who does not believe and he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. And then down in verse 16, for it says, look, work it out. Hang in there. Okay, fine. It's not exactly what you wanted it to be. It's not maybe what your ideal would be. But work it out if you can. Stay in there because God has an impact. Now His presence is involved. How do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? How do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? If we withhold our effort to do good, to contribute, because it seems fruitless to us, or because we do not see opportunity of reward, if you watch the wind, you'll never sow. If you wait until everything is in place, the work will not get done. God says, how do you know that this isn't going to work? Stay in there and make your commitment and keep your word. And be a light, an example, and pray for God's assistance in that way. You see, the lower our expectations are, the less we're going to do. Many individuals, it would seem now, and some of the membership of the church that is scattered in various ways have begun to say, well, the gospel is finished, it's over, it's done, the work in that sense is done, and we're just now down to preparing the church. You know, that could even be true. But how can you ever make that decision? God has to make that choice. Because if you ever do indeed believe it and the work is yet to be done, then we would sit down and not do it. How can we ever make that choice? Let the fruitfulness of God's Holy Spirit be His choice. But we must do whatever it is that we can. The more Murphy's Law colors our vision, the bleaker our view of this life is going to be. And I think we have to guard ourselves against that. Murphy's Law is funny because at some level it's true. If it had no relationship, then it wouldn't mean anything to us at all. How can we be pessimistic and still live this life by faith? How can those two values reside side by side in our minds? In the book of James, chapter 1, verse number 2, talks about counting it joy in the trials and tests because you're looking past the physical. And Mike made a distinction between the fact we struggle in this flesh, but we have to look at that and beyond. We have to see a greater purpose, a broader perspective, a longer term issue than that. Verse number 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives it liberally and without reproach, it will be given to him. But don't be pessimistic about it. Don't doubt. Don't hang back and say, well, maybe I'll get it, or maybe I won't, or maybe God wants me to understand, or maybe He doesn't. It says, let him ask in faith with no doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. When you doubt, you have nowhere left to stand because you don't know where to stand or if to stand or to hold your ground or to move forward or to go back. We have to firm our focus in that way. Let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded and unstable in all his ways. Focusing on the failures at times of this flesh and this society and the values that are there, and letting that become embedded in us, impacts our spiritual focus. You look past the cancer. You look past the infirmity, the injury. You look past the pain. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. But it's something we must do. James said it so strongly. Let not that man suppose, he who doubts, that he will receive anything from the Lord, because he's unstable. He's not really fixed in place. Hebrews 11. The statements on this are incredibly strong, and I can see where the individual cried out to Christ, and he said, I believe, but help my unbelief. You know, I want to go where I need to be. Help me get there. So nobody's saying that we just arrive and we're firmly and easily in place. But we have to guard ourselves from the pessimistic, cynical attitudes that would indeed infest us when we focus on this flesh and the way matters sometimes play out, specifically the politics we have watched over the last few weeks. Hebrews 11 talks about faith, and surely we've read this so many times, it's almost rote to us. Verse number 6, because it talks about Abel and the example, and it talks about Enoch here and things that took place. And verse 6, without faith, it is impossible to please him or God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. I had a chance to speak with someone this week who is not a member of the Church of God in that way historically, has come into contact with it, and had a chance to begin to talk about a particular infirmity that individual had. And, you know, when you lay out for someone that God heals, and you're also talking to someone in that sense who is just coming into contact in certain ways and making decisions on what that relationship maybe will be, and yet you're realizing that if they have the faith to understand that God heals and gives promise, and this option is there, and in his mercy he intercedes for us, I wanted to somehow take that faith and just hand it to this person myself, because I know indeed what God's great blessings in this way often are. And yet I also know that God has a greater purpose than just us feeling good. But I thought, if only I had some way to express to this individual about godly faith. Now, God will have to grant that faith, and the relationship will have to build. But it was something I wished I could package and hand across and say, here's what it is. It comes in relationship to God. Satan points out corruption, hopelessness, and failure to us, and he puts it right between our eyes. God, conversely, is directing us toward faith, thankfulness, and joy. Being thankful for everything, for all that God is doing in our lives. Satan is the most negative being that there is. He's the father of lies. He's the accuser of the brethren. And yet God looks on us even in our sin and sees our potential. In fact, Christ died while we were yet sinners so that God could clean us up. Just the antithesis. God looks at the potential of his kingdom. And Satan focuses on every failure, every fraud, and every fault. God knows how evil the world is. God sees the injustice, he sees the poverty, and he sees the disease. And God is not negative. And if I can say it, and I mean it, thank God he's not cynical, which means he could not look to see the value in us. God calls us to rise above a negative point of view, to use our gifts in service to him in a cheerful way. Romans 12 is a passage about spiritual gifts. Romans 12. I won't go through all these gifts necessarily. There's a passage here. It starts, describing gifts around verse 6, but you go on down here to verse 8. He who exhorts in exhortation, it's just saying use these gifts. It talks about if you teach, then teach well. If you exhort, then exhort well. He who gives, then give liberally. He who leads, be diligent. He who shows mercy, to show mercy with cheerfulness. Yeah, I'll forgive you, but don't you ever do that again. It's talking about using gifts in a totally different way to actually cheerfully show mercy, to want to show mercy. You don't do that if you're a cynic or a pessimist or thinking fundamentally negative in any way. When you give, to give liberally, if you lead, to be diligent. Why? Because you believe in fruit and production and opportunity and God's purpose. And we must be careful, brethren, that we are not drugged down by the pessimism of the society in which we live. We're lights. We're to shine brightly, positively, openly for all to see, so that they might see the hope that is in us, God calling others through his body, the church, again. Proverbs 17, again, talks about the impact of our attitude and approach. But Proverbs 17 and verse 20. He who has a deceitful heart finds no good. He who has a perverse tongue falls into evil. He who begets a scoffer does so to his sorrow. In other words, if you're passing that on, or if you have that that's in your environment, it's going to injure everyone who's there. The father of a fool has no joy, but a merry heart does good like medicine. A broken spirit dries the bones. Our attitude should be like a salve, brethren, to those around us, because God has shown us a bigger and a greater thing, and we are not confined to the hopes and desires of this flesh alone. But even in the flesh, brethren, we should be positive. We should be encouraged. We should have hope. When Paul was writing to Timothy, I think I enjoy the books of Timothy in a special way, because I think of maybe sitting in that sense at Paul's feet and learning from him. But Timothy was like a son to Paul. And in 2 Timothy 1 and verse number 6, Paul's kind of stiffening Timothy's backbone a little bit and telling him to stand up and be a little firmer in his convictions and to lean more to God and depend on God. He says, I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear or negativity or being downcast, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Being positive directs us to God even during our trials and duress. And it actually gives us a sound and proper mind. Even in our trials. Jeremiah 29 is interesting because we have here a situation of great duress. Jeremiah 29, and yet God didn't say, well, go ahead and nurse your wounds. Notice this. This is Jeremiah's letter, and it's when the Jews were going into captivity. Jeremiah 29. These are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the remainder of the elders who were carried away captive. It says they were Nebuchadnezzar had carried away captive from Jerusalem to Babylon. How much worse could it get? To be drug away from your home, your country, your nation, your family goes out into captivity. And then Jeremiah passes on God's instructions for them. Verse 4, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all those who are carried away captive, whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and dwell in them, plant gardens and eat their fruit, take wives, beget sons and daughters, take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands so they may bear sons and daughters. Why? Because there is a future, and I am going to work with you yet, and I want you to produce and accomplish and grow and overcome, that you may be increased there and not diminished. And seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray to the Lord. Pray to the Lord for your captors. and the land in which they placed you in your captivity. Pray to the Lord for that. Be thankful for everything, for its peace, for in its peace you will have peace. I've prayed about this presidential election for months now on a very serious basis, and I continue to, for the sake of God's people and the sake of this nation, that we might have opportunity to do God's work according to His will. I sometimes can't hardly believe that at times that members of God's church appear to be so uninvolved by comments some have made in that process and those concerns. I don't know how we can just write that off and ignore it in some way until it becomes a crisis on the other end. God says, well, pray for the peace of even where I have taken you captive, because if they have peace, it will be your peace as well. I don't assume that my perspective on it is the middle of the road of the church, but I don't know how we cannot be invested in what is happening and our concerns and the petitioning of God with our prayers in this way. A key element of being positive, brethren, is simply being thankful. We don't know. I mean, be thankful. You don't know what things are going to work out. I was reading some sermon notes from Paul Lukey that I had from years back, and I was looking through them and some of the illustrations, and he had an illustration in there. He said there was a farmer had a horse, and the horse ran away, and the neighbor said, oh, that's bad. And the farmer said, well, I don't know if that's bad or good. You go, huh? Your horse ran away. What do you mean you don't know if that's bad or good? Well, the horse ran away up in the mountains, and there was a stallion and picked up some mares and came back in a week or two and brought back four mares with it. And now the mares are standing out in the field with the stallion, and the neighbor said, oh, that's good. And the farmer said, well, I don't know if that's bad or good. And they go, what? So the farmer's son went out there and was going to break some of the mares to ride and use, and he got bucked off and broke his leg. And the neighbor said, oh, that's bad. And the farmer says, well, I don't know if that's bad or good. And they thought he's nuts. And so the son is now laid up with his leg broken. He's got a cast. And then the army comes by needing soldiers to recruit for war, and the son had a broken leg, and oh, that's good. See, the point being made was, you know, all things work together for good to those who love God or called according to His purpose. When we look at the moment, that's bad. Or that's good. But if we're looking at the fact that God is working with us, then we can be thankful in all things. We can look past the trauma or the stress, and we can look at God's longer, greater purpose. Because we don't know, in that sense, necessarily the end of those things. A key element in being positive is simply being thankful. Instead of focusing on what we don't have or can't get, then we focus on what it is that we have to do or the blessings that are already in place. We need to make a special effort, brother, to encourage each other. I mean, this is an incredible blessing that we can sit here on the Sabbath and be together and worship God and serve before Him in this way. We need to laugh more. Take life in some ways a little lighter. Seek out positive things. Live on the bright side. God's way works. And it ought to look like it works from our own lives as well if He's working in us. God's way works. But we have to choose, in that sense, to rejoice before Him. Deuteronomy 30, God said, I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Choose life. Choose. There's two options out there. We can be negative, we can be positive. We can be encouraged, we can be depressed. God says, choose that which is life. Reject the death, reject the curse. Don't go that way. He says that you and your descendants may live, really live. Pass on those blessings in that way. When we choose to be negative, of course, we don't think of it as choosing to be negative. Negativity is something that just kind of descends on us. It's a choice, brethren. God says choose life. When we choose to be negative, we become hardened emotionally and stressed, and our confidence is shaken. God said in Hebrews, hold on to your confidence. Secure that. Grab onto it and hang on for your life. Righteousness is God's way, and God's way works. In the book of Proverbs 12, going back, verse 25. Anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. The righteous should choose friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. When Judas goes in and buys down to the lowest common denominator, he infects those around him, and then all of a sudden you have a group of individuals saying, "What in the world, Christ, are you doing?" But it was an infection that entered at a particular point. Down in verse 28. In the way of righteousness is life, and in its pathway there is no death. When God says choose life, that brethren, by his calling and opening our mind, that is a conscious thing that we do. The magazine we publish is called The Good News. That fundamentally is what the gospel is intended to be. When Christ stood up and proclaimed what he was quoting from in the New Testament, Isaiah 61, the gospel. I want to read you the original version where he was quoting from in Isaiah 61. Christ stood up and said, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me," remember the account, "because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor." Good news, to preach the gospel to the poor. Good news, good tidings. That's what our book's about. "He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord," the Jubilee year is when freedom was established. It goes on and it talks about accountability as well. Accountability is indeed part of the gospel message, but the gospel message fundamentally is good news. It should be seen, brethren, in our personal lives, on our face, in our words. It ought to be floating in our minds. It ought to be the way that we look out and see life itself, the potential indeed that is there. We need to be thankful for the fact that Christ sacrificed himself for us and opened that way as a result for us to be in his kingdom. We need to keep that prayerfully in mind. We need to give the evidence of that by our thoughts and our deeds, and it needs to be visible to those whom God indeed chooses to call now in this life, who are looking for that light, brethren, that they so desperately need.